And I guess I'm hoping and praying that I'm making the right move, but I'd say it'd be interesting for you to have maybe some more discussion, or maybe somebody knows something about the gas line. You know, if there's any way of getting around it, calling townspeople, maybe somebody that could possibly give us a idea that maybe get the number reduced. I could possibly share it with some other people on the block itself, but they want to go gas wells out. So I think they have the same idea that I have in mind.
N2EO with a suggestion, Vic.
Go ahead, Rich. N2EO.
Okay, so maybe he can circumvent the whole problem by using LP gas. I don't know, are there liquid propane dealers on Long Island? Because you go upstate, you see houses, you see mobile homes, and they usually have two tanks that run in tandem together that go into the gas line. And the LP dealer, you can either bring the tank to the dealer and exchange them, or they'll pick them up and even hook them up for you, Gadget.
Yeah, I think the energy content, though, of LP gas and the so-called natural gas, there's a difference. And I'm not sure, but there could be a significant difference in dollars. In the case of a rural area where there are no gas lines and you have no choice, the LP is the way to go. I wonder if that's the right way to go in Rich's town, where he lives, in Levittown. We'll have to do some further investigation on that. I wonder if Rich has ever seen an LP tank in Levittown. Maybe not. I see the foot chances there's a town ordinance against it when they've got the natural gas pipes already in the ground in most portions of the community. So I think you're saying, Rich, that for whatever reason, they never ran a natural gas pipe down Eileen Avenue where you live. Is that true, Rich? Go ahead.
Just a suggestion. Maybe you should go on the internet and see if there's an LP. Sorry. Have a call. See if there's an LP dealer in this area. He might be pleasantly surprised. And he can check it out and find out what the differences are. I know you have to use different nozzles. Sorry to interrupt, Kendrick.
Yeah, go ahead to you, Rich, and to GUK.
Okay, Dick. Thank you, Rich, for the... I thought about it also, believe it or not. I thought about the LP, but I don't like the idea of having those tanks. And not that I'd rather spend the money getting the gas line in and all that nonsense. But I'm going to look for it. You know, we've been kicking this around for a couple of weeks. I finally called the Wilco and spoke to him about it. Naturally, they call me back with that disastrous news. Because they told me that after 100 feet, you're going to have to pay the difference. But I do have people interested. And I guess we'll see how it works out. But like I said, the boiler does have to be replaced. I don't want to wait until the thing leaks or we have a flood. Lots like that. And like I said, Dick, knowing the situation we have out there with providers of oil, which I hate these people, gas, oil, I'd rather pay more, to tell you the truth. I can't imagine having to pay more than $777 when oil is at its peak. You know, like, it was like $4-something a gallon, or $4 a gallon. God help us, did it might go up. I mean, why it went down, well, I guess all the politics and nonsense. But anyway, real quick, if you're still there, Rich, I just want to make a quick comment that your bird slug, I was going to break it. Let me just look out a second. Okay. Your bird slug, most likely the diode is good, and most likely one of the little wires with that little coil in the back that senses the RF that goes into your slug there is broken off. I had a couple of them like that. I never have a bad diode. The hardest problem is pulling off that little plastic cover in the back. And if you do get it off, you tend to, you know, bend it or smash it or, you know, make it not look like it used to look, but the slug still works perfect. It's just a matter of getting that little wire back onto the contact and your slug is right back where it was. But that's the problem I found with a bunch of slugs. It was that just that little tiny wire and a little sensing coil. So you might think about that. Just rip that plastic off and boom, get inside. way you go.
N2GUK, is there a W2GUK, is there a magic way of getting that Teflon-looking cover off, Rich? Go ahead.
Well, I tell you, if there is, Dick, I don't know. I don't know about it. I've always done it the hard way, you know, bare pliers, you know, brute force, stuff like that, which I would have liked to have done the nice way. Actually, what I wanted to do was order a new cover from Bert and probably pop it right back, you know, pop a new cover on where I've destroyed the old one. I know nothing about pulling the cover off itself, I think.
Where you did remove the cover, do you believe that the old one was held on with a very stretchy kind of glue?
No, I think it was formed where it popped into the slug itself. From what I've seen, there was no glue at all.
So you think it was some kind of a very elaborate force fit?
Oh, you know it. Leaving it up to them, you know. They do things so that you can't get it apart, and if you do, you destroy it.
And I guess you're saying there's no way of removing the label up front and getting a hold of some of the screws that take apart the mechanism itself?
Okay. No, I never tried that, Dick, to say the truth. But I noticed the coil is to the rear of the slug. So, to think that you would pull it apart and get to it, you know, I never tried that. I don't remember, in fact, to say the truth, I don't remember if I did or did not try that. But I know I just went right to the back. Actually, you can pop the cover off. That's where your little alignment pod is in the front. From what I remember, it was in the back, but I guess, Rich, you could look into it. Maybe somebody has a better idea than I have, but typically, as far as sending it back, just forget about it. I mean, I can imagine what you're going to charge it to start out with. It's just that you can do it yourself. It's kind of a self-explanatory thing. But as you know, the most likely little wire probably broken off from my the contact pad and stuff. And you're right back in shape.
And N2EO, go ahead, Rich. By the way, when it comes back to you, Mr. GUK, I see that the front cover in my case is held on with two little rivets. It looks like it could be disassembled. N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, that's an interesting idea, because, you know, the newer slugs use a... It's not metal. It's like a tape. In fact, if you press on it, you don't want to press too hard because it's like open in the front underneath. It's sort of like a mylar tape on the newer slugs. Maybe those rivets could be ground off with a Dremel and get in there. I wonder if there isn't some type of a clip holding the Teflon that Rich is talking about. Remove like a wedge or a clip, something that's, you know, that can be removed from the front and slip that cup off, can't it?
Yeah, I'm looking at one right now, and my first response on a bad one is going to be to remove those two rivets, see if there's a way to take it apart. There's also a pin sticking off to the side, which limits how far you can turn it, and that pin looks like it could be a retaining pin, although I'm not sure. And if I remove that pin, maybe something else can unscrew. There's got to be a way of taking this thing apart. And where Rich is fairly sure that the Teflon or the white piece of plastic on the bottom is not glued, it's some kind of a forced fit. Or maybe it's screwed in. I don't see any obvious threads on it, though. But I've got a bad one. I'm going to take it apart and see what I can find out. And with any further suggestions, give me your call letters right now on fixing a bird slug. K2LAW in the tech net.
Dick, another comment, N2GK. I don't know the exact problem that Richie's having with his slug, but a lot of times, the little contact on his side, right inside the bird, will not make with your particular bird slug. Now, I tell you, it's interesting because it might make with, let's say, 5 or 10 of the slugs, but not make with another one. So what we usually do is just make the little contact come out just a hair more and clean it up also, because they get dirty from, you know, metal to metal contact like that. You might want to clean your bird slug itself up, number one. Make sure it's nice and shiny, and the contacts, because that could be the problem too. Before you even pull the bird slug apart, it might just be the contacts on the slug, or that the contact on the side of the bird just doesn't like that particular slug, because I've had that problem over and over again.
Okay, you said you made the contact on the side of the slug stick out further. How did you do that? By putting a blob of solder on it?
No, negative, Dick. You don't want to do that. No, just get a screwdriver and just pry it out of here. And I do mean a here. Because if you pry that too much, the slug will not go in. It won't fit properly, because those set of contacts are very close to the slug itself. There's everything in the machine just right. You need to say true, you know, usage and age and so on. The contact tends to bend back, I guess, toward the right of the meter, away from the slug. So I would say clean that contact first. Clean the slug first of all, naturally. And then see if it might just work at that point, you know. It might just be the slug itself is dirty. But I would clean the contact tools. I would somehow maybe just scrape it just a tiny bit. But I think it's a piece of brass, and we wouldn't want to hurt the contact, because that contact's very important, especially to all the other good slugs.
Okay, so cleaning the contact on the slug, possibly prying it a little bit, giving a good hard look at the contacts on the meter body itself to make sure that they stick out far enough to pick up this contact. And I'll bet you there's a way you can put an ohmmeter across those two contacts also on the slug and make a confirmation that it is or is not working correctly. I'll bet you there's a way. Wonder if you've ever had any troubles with the bird slugs on your bird watt meter, Mel. And I think it's time we go to the mailbag. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No, this is K2KEY. The only thing I had is similar to what he just mentioned, that wasn't taking good contact. I cleaned them up, a couple of them, with just an eraser. Polished up the contact, seemed to take care of it, Dick. But, you know, you were mentioning about, I was going to say something about gas. We have gas heat here in Brooklyn, of course. They've been here for many years. And they usually offer first-time new customers here that are converting from oil, they put in a burner for you for a very low price, or for next to nothing, literally. Now, the first thing I noticed when we put in gas here, we originally had oil when we came in here. Stuff at the first winter with that oil burner, which was, didn't look so hot to me. I don't know. It just looked like an old piece of junk. And I threw it out because the oil tank also was threatening to leak. It had a wet, was wet on the bottom. But so we converted over gas. The one thing I did notice, my electric bill went down considerably, Dick, over.
How about that? So the electricity that powers the motor of the oil burner and its circulating pumps and so on. How about that? Now that you're buying gas, is there a way that you can tell us how many BTUs per dollar you're getting, or how many dollars per thousand cubic feet, or whatever? Over to you, Mel.
Our house is comfortable. It's warm, and the budget plan here is reasonable. Pay the same amount every month, and at the end of the year, either they give us a credit, or we can pack it on till the next into the next year. They usually settle up with us around July, June, or July. And as far as things like the chimney and all clean, I tried checking the chimney a few times. I cleaned it back myself, nothing really to clean out of there. And it's quiet, it's everything. So far, we're very satisfied with it over the years we've been here. And exact BTUs and all that, I don't know, Dick. I only can tell you that I haven't met anybody around here that, changed over going from gas back to oil over.
Okay, but from your gas bills, can you tell us what is the going rate in dollars per thousand cubic feet, if that's the way it's being sold? Go ahead.
I don't really know. I don't even look at it. I just pay the bill on the internet. It's very simple. They just remove it every month, send us a statement that was paid. And I really don't pay much attention to it, to tell you the truth. What we're exactly paying or whatever the story is, Dick, I just don't concern myself so much with it, basically, because I can't do much about it. But as far as, you know, working well, and also, you know, we get a power failure, I still have heat, over.
Yeah, that is kind of nice. Well, you don't have the blower, but at least you've got convection heat, is what I think you're telling me. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, good old radiators here, that's it. The original radiators are in the house here. Didn't throw them out. Big cast iron monsters. But I'll tell you, amazing. When they heat up, they stay warm for a long, long time, for hours. And it seems to be comfortable in a house, whereas a couple of new houses they built here, they got that heating system. They got these coils in the floor, you know, this hot water running through the floor. And the gas burner looks like a large carburetor. Really don't even have a chimney on it, just like a dryer vent. And it doesn't, I don't know, I'm going to these houses here, a number of new ones built here and all. I don't feel as comfortable here in those houses as I do in my house here with radiators, Dick, over.
So you got those big old-fashioned radiators, and I think you're saying yours is a gas-fired steam heat system. Is that true?
Yeah, Roger. Originally, this house was a coal, had coal stove, and with those radiators, with the steam business, everything is the same, except now the burner, the boiler is runs on gas, over.
Okay, very good. Go ahead, Eric. You know, I have gas heat in the house, but funny thing is the thermostat runs on electricity, you know?
Yeah. Tell us how you get heat without the thermostat being fired by electricity when your electricity fails, Mel. Go ahead.
That's a good old thermostat that's just a bimetallic type. Yeah, it has a clock on it so you can have the AM, PM. But if the electric goes out, I just take one wire off the transformer, put about a couple of batteries on there. All you need is 9-volt batteries, in fact, a few of them. And if it needs heat, it just closes the solenoid on the burner. That's all it is. It's just a simple solenoid gas valve, over.
So he's got a battery bypass, a battery backup system, Eric. Ain't that cute? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, that sounds cute, but in the city of New York, I don't know how old his boiler is, but as of, I think it was 12 years ago or 14 years ago, you can't have pilot lift furnaces anymore. The way it has to be is you turn the thermostat, goes on, closes the relay, lights the pilot same a couple gets hot, allows the gas valve to open. But it's probably got a real old boiler.
There's the next question, Mel. Do you have an old-fashioned pilot light, or your pilot light electrically fired?
Yeah, I've got pilot light burning in there. I've got a pilot light here, even a stove in the kitchen. Two of them. One, three of them. Two for the on the regular, the bottom stove, and one is in the oven stove. And the one on the burner downstairs, the boiler, is that with one of those sensors next to it that goes bad every so often and doesn't work then. You know, I always have an extra one of them around. You know, it sits next to the pilot light. In case the pilot light goes out, of course, it won't permit the main valve open, the main gas valve open. Now, they got the same thing, in fact. They got the same thing on the hot water boiler. I got a 50-gallon hot water tank here separately. And it's also got the same thing. It's got a pilot light in there that's also one of those little sensors, Dick, over.
K2YO.
K2YO, go right ahead. Start off with your name, sir. I know you, but I've forgotten it.
Good evening, Dick, Mel, and Manette. Regarding pilot lights in the city, they're actually converting back to pilot lights. Spoke of the grid, they actually prefer the pilot light viable than the firing. My experience of I replaced the 1941 boiler with a new set, and we are saving it to stay hot. So, for example, in the daytime, if the system thermostat calling for heat, it does not stay up to temperature. And the controller on the boiler actually knows when it also comes up to temperature. So, in the middle of the day, I'll go look at the boiler and boom, as soon as one of the thermostats calls for heat, it jumps here. So, it starts pumping. Got gas and an older, it costs us a couple $1,000, $4,000 or $5,000 to change it, but I'm going to say it's going to pay for itself.
Interesting information. Bernie, are you aware that your audio is quite low? Either that microphone is not happy, or your audio on the deviation on that particular rig is set low. Go ahead.
Yes, I apologize for that. This is my my Yaesu HT with the waterproofing is also soundproofing. So sorry about that. I'm going to bow out here, but I just wanted to throw in my 2 cents on that.
So are you saying you've waterproofed that HT? In other words, you've got a big plastic cover of some kind over it so that it can operate in the rain? Is that what you're saying, Bernie?
Negative. It's Yaesu EX7, and they come submersible. Not very far, you know, but they're designed so they can get wet. I'm outside right now walking in the rain, and not particularly worried. I'm worried more about me getting wet than the radio getting wet.
3 feet for 30 minutes.
3 feet for 30 minutes. How about that? Okay. I guess, Mel, it's time to go to the mailbag, and we probably got too deep into too many kinds of metric units last week. I bet you got some flack on that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Dick, one last comment.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, the difference, I heard you talking before, the difference between natural gas and LP gas. LP gas is liquefied petroleum gas, which is made from natural gas. Natural gas is generally methane. LP gas could be propane, butane, and basically that's done by cooling natural gas, and also it's made from the gases from petroleum when they're cracking it. The LP gas actually has more energy per volume than the natural gas does.
John, good to know. There was another person, a very noisy signal, who signed in. Maybe I can hear you on the input. Want to give it another try?
I had a question for Robert. This is WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. I know, Eric, you're into TV and HDTV. Is it true that the transmissions for HDTV are come across on 720 lines and that you really don't need the 1080 if you're going for these high-definition TVs? Or is the, you know, the transmissions being transmitted in 1080, or eventually will they go from 720 to 1080? I wonder if you know anything in that regard, Eric.
Sure, I can answer that for you. If I was going to buy a set, it's going to be 1080i, or 1080p16, not 1080p24. There's a difference. Okay, there's 1920 pixels on the line on the 1080. There's only 1280 pixels on the line on the 720. There's only 720 lines on the 720 up and down, and there's 1080 lines up and down on the 1080. If you are tuned to CBS, or you are tuned to NBC, or you are tuned to WNEC, and you're tuned to Channel 11, they will be transmitting 1080i. If you're tuned to Fox or ABC, you'll be seeing 720p. If you have a set that's capable of 1080i, and you watch the differences in the image quality between, say, what you're seeing on CBS, which is the best thing to look at because they don't transmit sub-channels, so they use all of their data space available for transmitting the 1080i picture. And you compare that to ABC, I think you'll want to watch the CBS faster than you'll want to watch the ABC. There's a difference, though. The 720 refreshes its rate every 60th of a second, the 1080 refresh rate is every 30th of a second. I personally like the 1080 because of this blending that goes on between the fields where you don't get that in the 720. So you see the difference in motion. Now, I don't like the stutter that the 720 makes. I prefer the smoothness of the 1080. There's two different camps as far as that goes. Some people like the progressive, some people like the interlaced. But I'm a fan of the interlace. That's a personal opinion. And, yeah, there's a difference. Does that help you?
And if I... I thought everything was being transferred at 720. I'm saying, what's everybody buying the 1080s for? But from what you said, some are 1080 and some are 720. Wow. Very good. You think they'd all be on the same page by now, but I guess it doesn't matter. It's going to come across your screen one way or the other. The quality would be different. Okay. Thank you, Robert. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Let me tell you for one more second, Dick.
Yeah, and I've got a question on the 1080 Progressive. I think you can ask for either 16 or 24 updates per second. Give us a couple words on that when you get a chance. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, well, let me tell you that most broadcast gear, up until the last couple of years, have all been produced in 1080. Panasonic was the pusher of 720, and Sony rather recent edition. Most production, including the sports stuff that you see, because ABC has their own trucks. That's the exception, but a lot of people use other people's trucks, and 1080 is pretty much the de facto standard. You won't get 1080 16, Dick, because that doesn't exist. 1080 24. What that means is it's progressive. It's actually segmented in terms of the way it's recorded, but that's another story. But that's only 24 frames a second. The reason for that is it's native to film. When you go to the theater and you watch a film, you are watching, actually, your eyes are seeing 48 frames a second, but the film has 24 pictures a second. So that actually takes less bandwidth than 1080i, believe it or not. And 1080p, which is progressive 1080, not 24, but 1080p 60, will not get broadcast because it takes up too many bits, and you don't have enough bandwidth for it. So 1080i is kind of like the top of the standards in terms of what can be transmitted over ATSC, because at a certain point the bit rate gets higher than 19 megabits and you can't transmit it. And by the way, your HD signals are compressed 50 to 1. Don't forget, the native rate for a 1080i HD signal is 1.16 gigabits. Step down to 6 megahertz. K2RIW, KE2RIW.
Whoa. So I think that means only a relatively small percentage of the picture is being updated frame to frame. Is that one way of looking at it?
Well, okay. Actually, MPEG is a series of different kinds of bit and bandwidth reduction methods. The simplest thing, what we call run length encoding, which is very easy to understand, is that if you have a white picture and the white picture says you have a white box on the screen and it occupies 3/4 of the screen, and you've got 1920 pixels on a line, the value of that white is a 255 or a hex FF, you can either transmit 1920 FFs, or you can say there's 1850 FFs, and in one byte say, I'm going to tell you how many FFs it sent, and in the next byte, it'll tell you, I'm sending you the actual value is FF. So what we do is we say, we've got this value for so many pixels, and there's a special header that goes with it that says that the following number is a value followed by how many times you need to repeat it. That's one form of compression. Then there's another form of compression, which is DCT encoding, or discrete cosine transform. And what you do is you take a 8x8 square of pixels, both vertical and horizontal, and you turn that into a series, actually can represent 8x8 pixels with one single number, which is a coefficient. And to turn that number back into a picture, you use an inverse cosine transform. That's another part of the method. Another part of the method looks ahead at three or four more frames and says, what stays the same in this position for how long? And you transmit that information. And there's a few more things that go that do it. And eventually you wind up having a compression ratio of about 52 to 1. K2RIW, K2J.
52 to 1. Wow. Now, in the old days, there was an MPEG 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. What MPEG number, if there is a simple answer to that, are we using these days? Eric, go ahead.
Okay, up until last year, there was only one standard, and that's MPEG 2 high level. Okay, there's different various forms of MPEG-2. As you're going to start to see in the receivers now, the receivers will be capable of decoding AVC, or H.267, which you probably heard about, which is an MPEG-4. It's a variation of MPEG-4. It's a very high quality. It takes up about half the bandwidth, or less than half the bandwidth of MPEG-2, but you pay for it in certain ways. But the mathematical geniuses in many of the encoding companies are being able to come up with methods to solve some of the blocking problems that MPEG-4 has, or HVC, which is AVC, which stands for Advanced Video Coding, which is now becoming the de facto standard, but you have all these hundreds of thousands of legacy receivers out there, so you're not going to be seeing broadcast stations transmitting AVC just yet. And then with the EVSB, or the Enhanced VSB, where they only use two symbols for motion, for moving receivers, that's another long discussion which we can get into another time, but it's actually part of the 8VSB system, and by only using two symbols, you can get away with a lot of stuff that you can't get away with using the 8 symbol. KTRWK2J.
Boy, television used to be nice and simple. Look what you guys have done to it. Keep it up, Eric. Good stuff. Mel, K2KEY, you've got it.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yes, with pleasure. You could use a soldering gun, pull a few tubes, and fix a television set. Now, forget it. But I guess that was the good old days, Dick, and I'm afraid they're well gone. And not to dwell on it anymore, where, as my daughter called me, a dinosaur. Always hear that. I'm going to look at something. I said, oh boy, and I tell her what was. She says, I don't want to hear about those things anymore. All right, so now we'll talk about HD, which I really don't care about. And I have no plans to buy one, to tell you the truth, Dick. I'll get one of those little boxes, and if it works, I'll be very satisfied, because all I need is the, basically, is the news and the weather in the morning and traffic reports. Over.
Okay, be careful. You and I are going to stay dinosaurs if we don't catch up to what the technical community is doing. What kind of mail you've been getting this week, Mel?
K2YO.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Sorry to interrupt the flow, but I've got some information on the bird watt meter repair, if anybody's interested.
Yeah, give us that info.
Okay, I got back to my office here, and I'm on the internet. There's a website. It's a gentleman's call sign, Kilo9SierraOscar.net, K9SO.net. And if you go there, scroll down, and on the right-hand side, there's a header for bird watt meters, and it's bird watt meter mods, M-O-D-S. And so go there, he shows how to disassemble them, has schematics, has various things about how to tune them, etc. So I think that's probably what you guys were looking for earlier.
Okay, do you think he's showing you a simple way of getting off that white cap in the front without damaging it?
Affirmative. They say that it is glued on, and they mentioned the solvent. I don't remember the name of it, but it mentions the solvent that they used to get off.
So once again, their website is K9SierraOscar.com, I think you said.
Negative, dot net, N-E-T.
K9SierraOscar.net, and then there's the section there about bird slug repair. And he's telling you how to do it as opposed to actually doing it. Is that true, Bernie?
Affirmative. There's a PDF file that shows how to take them apart and repair them, etc.
Good information. Thank you, Bernie. Okay, Mel, what kind of mail have you been getting this week, Mel?
Okay, a lot of positive mail. This is K2KEY thanking us for giving a more detailed discussion on the relationship of amperes, coulombs, and et cetera, et cetera, that we spent quite a bit of time on. I'm just reading over some here. Okay, here's one that may be interesting. Maybe good answer to this one. My repeater is basically stuff that we put together years and years ago, by one of the original people that were involved in establishing repeated, and we have to move it. We just moved it, and I'd like to know how I can check the alignment of the homemade duplexes. Give a description of the duplexer, how it's made, how they made this out of pipe, out of, let's see, describes it here, that was built by the guy who built it, and he says all the cavities were built with a 4-inch diameter drain pipe, and told me, and he goes on and on, how, but he says basically it's got a screw on top of it, and he'd like to know, how do you go about checking to make sure that they still align correctly, Dick, over?
Yeah, that's not an easy one. Under normal circumstances, when you're tuning a filter and you're using a sweep signal generator, some kind of a detecting device into an oscilloscope, or if you're doing the modern day equivalent with a network analyzer, it sweeps through frequencies and measures the response. Rarely do any of those instruments go beyond 70 or 80 decibels of dynamic range, very rarely. A real good duplexer on a state-of-the-art repeater requires that the transmit frequency goes through the transmitting filters out to the antenna. The receiving signal comes back from that antenna, goes through the receiving filters, and into the receiver. The receiver, with all of the filtering of the transmit side and the receiver side and everything else, the receiver should be isolated from the transmitter frequency by more than 120 dB. There are some real good duplexers that have 143 dB of isolation between the transmit frequency and the receiver. And the reason for that is when you're transmitting, let's say, 50 watts out of the transmitter, and you'd like no more than, let's say, a couple of microvolts of signal at that frequency to appear at your receiver while you're transmitting, and you're transmitting and receiving from the same antenna at the same time, that's a very delicate alignment of that duplexing filter. Lots of skill and special techniques are required to achieve that alignment. You don't just walk up to a sweep signal generator and start twisting the knobs. They're not going to succeed. There is a ARRO manual called Specialized Communication Techniques that describes the alignment procedure. And it's not easy. So I'm a little bit of loss for words to tell a guy, how do you go do it? I mean, I can't teach a person, on the assumption I could do it, I can't teach brain surgery in one tech net, so to speak. And we're getting into a fairly deep subject, rather specialized here when it comes to aligning a duplexing filter. If you happen to have a so-called split repeater, where there's one antenna doing the transmitting and another antenna some number of feet away doing the receiving, then alignment with simple equipment becomes definitely possible. But if it's a single antenna type repeater, where you're transmitting and receiving from the same antenna at the same instant of time, and only the quality of that filter, duplexing filter, and all of its interconnects and all of its individual type end connectors and jumper cables and everything else, unless all of that is top notch, it is extremely easy to run into what's called the desensitization problem. In other words, somebody gives you a weak signal, your receiver works like a charm. Your transmitter or your repeater turns on, and all of a sudden the receiver doesn't hear the signal anymore. That's called desensitization. Unless you get all of those decibels of isolation in that duplexing filter, you will have desensitization. Happens all the time. So, I didn't answer the question, but I'm starting to let the guy know how difficult it is to do that. It's a very specialized procedure, and only a person with some extra skills and just the right equipment can do it. K2KEY, how would you do it, Mel? K2RIW.
Okay, there we are. This is K2KEY. All right, I'm reading on here, and he says, yeah, they have a spacing between the transmit and the receive antenna of 150 feet, Dick. This is one of the old systems that I remember putting together basically the same thing. And with the homebrew, basically, I homebrewed the duplexes too. Oh boy. And I'll tell you how I did it. This is a long time ago. But I think with about a spacing of 150 feet, I have a basically a simple way of doing it, Dick. Over.
Yeah, now you stand a chance. Now it becomes easy. Because the spacing between the antennas is going to give you, I'm picking a number, 70 decibels of isolation right there. So 70 decibels of performance out of the duplexing filter. The performance requirement out of the duplexing filter just got relaxed. Now, just simply peaking up the transmitter on the transmit frequency, transmitting filters, peaking the receiver on the receiving frequencies, and doing a little bit of touch-up for isolation will get you there. Now it's easy. So is that approximately what you did, Mel? Go ahead.
Yes, we're not going to get the tone this time. Okay. Yeah, basically, that's how we did it those days. In other words, you take the cavity and you tune the cavity to deliver maximum power into a 50-ohm load. Then you do the same procedure, you go to the receiver cavity, and you do the same thing, except you put the transmitter now on the receive frequency. So that way, it's almost very good, Dick. I know we basically how we started out with this repeater. We took a radio that time that was called the Drake TR-22. Which was basically my first handy talkie, really, if you want to really talk about handy talkies. I mean, it wasn't handy, but it was a talkie. And we split it. Because there was two chassis in there, the receiver deck and the transmitter deck. Very easy to take it apart, you know. And that's how we basically put together the first repeater, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I own a TR-22. And mine's fed with a GLB synthesizer way back in the 70s. Old piece of equipment. And that was the first handy talkie. It had a whip antenna out of it. Had a battery pack inside. You could walk around and talk with that TR-22 Drake rig. And I think there was like 12 crystals you could select with a rotary dial in the front panel. Transmit and receive crystals, I think, were all separate before you put in the synthesizer. Good old rig. As I said, I still own one. If I was a smart guy, I would have sold it a zillion years ago when it still had some value. What you described is the right approach. And now, with the separation of the antennas, it becomes a lot easier. A whole lot easier. Just tweaking for peak response will do it. There was another comment I was going to make about the TR-22. I think the TR-22 put out 5 watts, but I'm not sure about that. Is that approximately what it put out? Had a nice little coil cord going into a tubular microphone with a little bit of a black switch on the side, the push-to-talk switch. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, no, TR-22 is like 1.5 watts, I think. Yeah, about 1.5, that's about it. And, you know, had the rechargeable, one of the first radios to have rechargeable batteries in it, AA batteries in it. So, it was quite unique for it, and I had a nice little leather case they gave you with an arm strap, and like you say, that microphone with the coiled cord with the switch on it for push to talk, and would you believe I ran a marathon, one of the early marathons in New York at the at Central Park we ran it, and I carried the TR-22. I was the first cam to operate in the New York City Marathon with a rig. Over.
Did you carry some spare batteries? And by the way, because the internet is down, that beep is only resetting of the internet. As long as the carrier gets dropped, even without the beep, you're resetting the machine. So did you have some spare batteries to run through the whole marathon? Mel, go ahead.
Well, I ran part of it with it and then passed it off to somebody there that was with me at the time. She didn't care for carrying it at the time, really. But she held on to it for me. That's a long story. I better not go no further with that. But anyhow, I did it actually a couple of hams with Aaron. It was on Simplex. Didn't you have a repeater? in that part of the city at the time. I mean, this is going back a good number of years. Quite a difference in lifestyle and everything from those days, Dick. But it was a lot of fun anyhow with some of this early stuff. And okay, so basically, as I said, Dick and I basically agree that the best way is just peak it on the transmit with a dummy load, the duplexer, then do the same thing on the receiver. On the receiver side, use the transmitter, but on the receive frequency, and that should put you in good, if you really want to check it. Most likely, if it was done originally that way and nobody touched it, I would bet it most likely doesn't even have to be touched, Dick, over.
I agree with that. And because most repeaters will have the transmitter and receiver in the same cabinet, the next thing you got to be a little bit careful about is make sure you've got good double shielded coax cable coming from the receiving antenna and going to the transmitting antenna, and that the power supply wiring for transmitter and receiver is sufficiently isolated. If some of the transmitting frequencies come out of the power wiring, the 12-volt wiring for the transmitter, and get radiated into the cabinet and eventually end up into the power wiring for the receiver, you can get cross-coupling through your repeater just through its power wiring. Very easy to happen. Where it really happens is guys will say, gee, I'd like to have a little bit more power out of the repeater. I'm going to put a brick amplifier on it, a Mirage Baker 1016. And it's a pretty-looking amplifier. It puts out some nice power. If you put it in just the right conditions, it's reasonably stable, not always. You have to do a little bit of playing around with lead lengths of the coax cables going in and out to stop it from oscillating sometimes. But the well-kept secret is a Mirage Baker 1016 amplifier. It can put out 160 watts with 10 watts in, but at least 1 or 2 watts comes roaring out of that 12-volt lead that goes into that package. And that's going to get sprayed all around your cabinet. There's lots and lots of guys who had a real happy repeater until they added that brick amplifier. And until they eventually put all kinds of shielding around that amplifier and shielded its wiring and bypassed its wiring. Until they did that, the brick amplifier desensitized their receiver of their repeater. And it was happening right in the cabinet, independent of the duplexing filter or antenna system. So these are some of the things to worry about. You guys, when you were splitting up your Mirage, when your Drake TR-22, and I guess that became your first repeater, the fact you're only running in a half, 1.5 watts, made life a lot easier. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, was beginning, and basically very simple, you know, get something like that up and running. I don't know what happened to it. I wonder where it went to. I gotta ask sometimes. I don't even run into this guy anymore. I don't know what happened. We, you know, it's funny how people, you know, sort of, we drift apart. Don't keep in touch. That's one of the things that's not really right. But upstate New York, I used to go up there quite often and all, and I sort of cut that out from many years ago. Other things came up, so I sort of lost contact with them. All right, very good. So, shall we try one more?
We got lots of time. Go right ahead.
Hey, we got a lot of stuff here. VHF, UHF stuff all of a sudden. Here's one. Okay, in fact, I'll concentrate on some of this stuff tonight. I have an amplifier. You just mentioned an amplifier. Listen to this one. It was an amplifier that was put out in, what year did you say it is? Can't make it out. I'm trying to make this out. Oh, 1972. 1972, it was a 2-meter amplifier that is built around a 4CX250B. Oh, do I remember that. A single 4CX250B. It worked perfect up to recently. Now it stopped working. I replaced the tube, had it spare, but still doesn't work. Can you give me some ideas what to look for in this amplifier? It's all yours, Dick.
Yeah, I own a number of 4CX250B amplifiers, wrote some articles on them, and doesn't work, I presume, means that he applies drive to it and is not getting the power output he wants. And true of almost all pieces of equipment, when you start doing troubleshooting, the very first thing to do is to measure the power supply voltages. Are they there at the time they're supposed to be there? If you wanted full power out of a 4CX250B, you're putting close to 2,000 volts on the plate. You're putting something like 350 volts on the screen grid. And if it's Class C FM service, like we're using right now, you're putting something close to minus 90 volts on the control grid. So the first thing to worry about is the 2,000 volts on the plate, is the 350 volts approximately on the screen grid, the approximately minus 90 or minus 70 volts, depending on what service you're running, on the control grid, is the cathode grounded, is the filament getting 6.0 volts, not 6.3. That tube runs on 6.0 volts. Let me drop. 6.0 volts AC usually is on the filament. Pins 1 and 8, I think they are, on that tube. And if you prove to yourself that all those voltages are present, when the transmitter is in the transmitting mode, some transmitters will have a push-to-talk switch where if you don't ground something, the tube is not turned on. So is all the right turn-on commands being given? And once you've fulfilled all of those requirements, the commands are given, the voltages are present, and if the tube is good, and he's already replaced the tube, the chances of getting two bad tubes in a row are pretty slim. After that, is the drive signal really getting to the grid? Is the grid resonated? Is the plate circuit resonated? Is the power output circuit being properly connected? There might be a transmit-receive relay. Is the relay being flipped at the right time when you're transmitting? So step by step, you have to confirm all of these things before that tube and that amplifier can come alive. I bet you've got a couple more tricks on what you would be testing, ML. K2KEY, K2RIW. I bet you've used that tube.
Yeah, I've used many of them, have many transmitters with them, as you know. Yeah, this is K2KEY. As Dick have more or less covered it, the plate voltage, you've got to be careful now. Remember, this is not a solid-state unit, and it has some potent power in the power supply. As Dick says, the single tube usually ran somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 volts on the plate, and had approximately on the screen approximately around 250 volts. The bias supply was around minus, I think, 50. And as Dick says, check, make sure the filament voltage is there, that the 6.0 filament voltage, you know, is there. Many times you'd be amazed, the filament transformer could open up and the filament is out, and that will stop the whole thing from working. A lot of people just take for granted that, the, you know, they've never checked the 6.0 because you can't see the filament lighting like you used to be on the old tubes. You know, you see the light, actual light. You're not going to see these tubes light up in front of you. So you've got to make a test, really, to see if you've got that, that 6.0 volt. Usually that was between the ground and the filament, one side of the filament is grounded, because usually the filament, one side of the filament is grounded with the cathode. They both, that was, I think, in 2 and 3, I think they used to ground that. Am I correct, Dick?
There, I'm not sure. I don't have the 7203 or 4CX250B tube manual in front of me, the RCA transmitting tube manual. But that's easy to confirm. My guess is that tube is probably, even in the radio amateur's handbook, the older issues. Go ahead.
Roger. No, I remember offhand. Gee, I had, Dick, I dealt so much with that tube. I worked so much with that tube. They fed me from my kilowatt mobile rig to the 2-meter amplifiers, HF amplifiers. As soon as I got a hold of those tubes, I had so many of them, you know, they were so reasonably priced at the time. Literally, I got some of them for nothing. And in fact, I made up a tester. I'll never forget that. That's a whole other thing. Just to see if they go or no-go on them. I remember correctly, basically, you grounded pins 2, 4, 6 and 8 were grounded. No, no, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 8. Let me get it right. We're grounded. Write that down. 2, 4, 6, and 8 were grounded, plus pin number 3, which was one side of filament, also went to ground. Pin 7 is the other side of filament. Pin 1 is the screen. That I can remember distinctly. And on the bottom, you'll see a key. That was where the control, the signal goes in. That's the control grid. I remember that quite well, the layout of it, because I looked at so many of them over.
Yep, center pin is the control grid, and that's the one that's attached to my piece of strip line on the 2-meter and 432 amplifiers that I built. Awful nice tube. Something like 17 decibels of gain. A couple of watts in, and quite a few hundred watts out. Really happy tube. And can take an awful lot of abuse as long as you're pushing enough air through it. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. Yeah, roger. It works, like I say, works quite well. You can, you know, imagine the age of that tube. They go back some of the original of IMAX development in the ceramic tube department there. And those days, you could buy them. They were reasonably priced tubes. Now they've gone off the deep end. I got a couple of ceramic tubes in my couple of my amplifiers, both my Collins amplifiers and the homebrew amplifiers, these 3CX800. Of course, you're to replace them. A week's pay now, Dick. Over.
Yeah, the 4CX250Bs were being used in the FAA repeaters all over the United States. And they would change out those tubes after 1 year or 2 years of service, something very short. So the surplus market was filled up with those tubes. You could buy them in extremely good shape for $5 in those days. Nowadays, my guess is the surplus market on those is almost gone. And as such, to buy them brand new, they're probably, what, $200 a piece, some crazy number like that? Go ahead.
Yeah, they've gone ridiculously high now. You know, for so-called the imports, they come in from the Soviet Union. In fact, now you know something? They're not importing them anymore. The Soviet Union, I understand, does not want to sell to the American market anymore. These development that they came up with, the modifications and everything, you know, they changed the numbers somewhat around or whatever. And it's a whole big deal now that I understand it, just not shipping them in anymore directly, Dick. Over.
Yeah, for a long time, the Svetlana company in the Soviet Union was selling some very nice tubes. Are you sure that they're no longer being sold in the States? And even if that's true, I guarantee the way these amateurs operate, they got so darn many friends in Europe. They'll tell their friend in Europe, hey, please buy me a Svetlana tube. Here's some extra money, then ship it to me. I bet you that's what's going on, even if that decision's been made. Go ahead.
Yeah, roger, something's going on, because I don't even see them advertised anymore. I used to see their advertisements all the time in the magazine. You don't see it at all anymore. And I believe that's the only way you're going to get them through the somebody in Europe or something. I don't know what the situation is. I didn't follow it that close, but I understand there is a whole different situation now with getting those tubes. All right, anyhow. yeah, I think I have still quite a number of the 250s still around, Dick. Over. So I think I'll hang on to them for a while. Over.
WSON questions, Dick?
Paul Romania for the Antillanennial. Good evening.
Okay. And something about Romania. We'll get to you in a second. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick. Curious about, you made a thing out of the 6 volts versus the, say, 6.3 volts. What difference is that 3/10 of a volt? I mean, it's a filament, or is this filament part of a, you know, cathode system? Isn't the filament independent of the cathode grid and screen and plate? And even if it was, you know, I mean, why is that 0.3 of a bulb so critical if it's only, you know, really heating the